You're listening to the Superhuman Channel. We're ripped and we're ready. This is the Superhuman Channel, doing reps with the weight of the world.
The following paid program does not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the staff and management of Tri-Scepter Productions or the Superhuman Channel. Tri-Scepter Productions and the Superhuman Channel are not responsible for any claims, warranties, or guarantees made during this program.
Prepare to experience the strongest radio allowable by law. Secrets will be revealed. Myths dispelled. From the studio gym where excuses never apply. It's Superhuman Radio with your host, Carl Lenore.
Hey, welcome back. It's another episode of Superhuman Radio, jam-packed with information coming right at you. Okay. During the first hour, we're going to cover two topics. First, we're going to talk to Dr. Jason Lake, Department of Sports and Exercise Sciences at the University of Chichester, about how knee wraps affect the back squat. Perfect, because I trained legs today, and I squatted and deadlifted. Okay. Then we're going to switch up things a little bit, and we're going to talk to Dr. Casey Vickers from Vanderbilt University, Department of Medicine, about what happens when we divorce HDL from cholesterol. Are there different things that happen? Should we throw the baby out with the bathwater, keeping them both connected when we talk about markers for atherosclerosis? Then we're going to change it up and be joined all the way from Munster, Germany, by the brilliant and talented Adele Musa as we perform the Subversity Science Roundup, where Adele applies the Subversity Sniff Test to science in the news, where we break through the sound bites and get right to the meat of science that interests you and me. Let's get started. All the way from the UK, we have Dr. Jason Lake. How you doing, Dr. Lake?
Hey, good. How are you?
Fantastic, fantastic. So first of all, what even made you look at how knee wraps affect back squats?
We have quite a few students that gravitate towards the biomechanics field on our sport and exercise science undergraduate and master's degrees. And obviously they bring their training interests into the lab with them, and they try to use those to obviously get an idea of what the sort of concepts we teach them on the courses sort of actually mean, and try and take some sort of meaning from them. And a lot of people come to us, and when they try to do their undergraduate or postgraduate research dissertations, want to use or study areas that they're interested in. And this was exactly the case for this particular study. And it's it essentially stems from some work from one of our undergraduate students, a guy who's particularly talented in the area. He wanted to, he like yourself, trained back squats using knee wraps, but wasn't really sure what the effect on it was. And when he looked into the area, realized that there had been actually sort of very little in terms of biomechanical research on the area.
Well, there's a large faction of what are now calling themselves, or have been calling themselves for quite some time now, raw lifters, who argue that power lifters who use gear, and we're not talking about drugs now, we're talking about shirts and briefs and pants and so on and so forth, and wraps and belts and everything else that goes along with it, have an unfair advantage, where the power lifters who use the gear say, look, the gear just keeps us from injuring ourselves while we're using this kind of weight. And we actually do a show every other Thursday called the Roundtable Discussion on Strength and Hypertrophy, where one of my co-hosts is a world-class powerlifter. He's in his late 40s now. Last time he competed, he squatted 1,040 pounds. But obviously he squatted with knee wraps. And the outfit that the squatters wear looks like a short brief thing with straps that go over the shoulders. And so we've had these discussions, and he does distinguish when he talks about lifting that he did this lift raw or he did this lift wearing gear. So clearly the powerlifters recognize that using this stuff gives them some sort of an advantage. And I think it's interesting that you looked at this knee wraps, because these of all seem to have the least potential of advantage to offer somebody, and it's thought that they protect the knees more than anything else. So how did you perform the study? How was the study designed?
It was a relatively simple design, in as much as we wanted to quantify the mechanical demands first and foremost. We wanted to see if there's a difference in normal unwrapped bat squat performance, and then obviously bat squat performance wearing knee wraps. The easiest way for us to do it and to accommodate the relatively wide stance that most powerlifters like to use in bat squat performance was to use two force platforms. So we could record the ground reaction forces that were applied through the feet from both the left and the right foot independently.
Now, these force platforms are nothing more than scales, correct? But they're large platform scales, so you can tell how much force is being applied to the base of each foot independently, right?
Exactly. They're essentially bathroom scales, but very expensive, very sensitive bathroom scales.
Right.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And in tandem with this, I mean, it allows us... A bathroom scale will give you a number with regards to your weight, but what these will also do is record how that force is applied over a period of time, both horizontally, but also in the horizontal directions as well.
Interesting.
And we were interested also in looking at how the force was applied forward and backward, because that would give us an indication of how the foot interacted with the ground. So, for example, if the lifter was tilted forward when he wore the knee wraps, then what we would see is that would be reflected with the ground reaction forces that we recorded.
Right.
Okay.
Interesting.
We also recorded the motion of the barbell from side on to get an idea of the trajectory of the barbell, so whether that movement pattern was affected by wearing knee wraps or not.
So, in other words, theoretically, you're looking for the horizontal plane that the bar travels from the standing position to the seated position down in the hole and then back up again, correct?
Exactly, yeah. But we started from the top, down to the bottom position, and then back up again. So we looked at the trajectory over the full range of motion.
How many subjects were in this study?
Well, that's the thing, you see. We need to be quite careful with this and any sort of big claims that we make, because we only used 10 subjects.
Were these well-trained subjects? Were these subjects who had acquired a certain modicum of strength through training?
These were, now obviously, how we sort of define training experience is obviously quite subjective. I would say moderately trained.
How did you assess what their one rep maximum was, and was there an average one rep maximum that these guys?
The guys had to perform their one repetition maximums in a separate laboratory-based test or laboratory-based session, and that was without wearing knee wraps, and the average was 160 kilos.
That's not shabby.
Yeah, well, absolutely, it's not shabby, but what I want to be careful of is, of course, that when we more often than not talk about bat squats that have been performed with knee wraps, we're talking about big, big weights. Like
yes.
Your friend
yes.
Squatting 1,000 pounds.
Right. Okay. So now,
you've got to differentiate.
Were you critical of form? In other words, did everyone have to go to parallel before they would? So, like a traditional powerlifting event, the lifter would get down into the hole and wait for the command to push out of it before standing back up again.
Absolutely.
So you did the same thing?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. So. Was this a crossover type study? Did you take individuals and assess them with and without wraps, or did you have a with wrap and a without wrap group?
No, so they did both. So they basically, one half of the cohort performed their three singles, with 8% of their one repetition max with wraps first, and then did the three single repetitions, without wraps, and then the other half of the cohort did exactly the opposite.
They did them without wraps and then with wraps.
Yeah.
Okay. So, what was the findings?
Well, the findings, to be honest with you, completely threw us a little bit, because what we found was that, I mean, the long and the short of it was, to give you a general answer, was that when you wear knee wraps, you can move quicker. Okay. You can lower yourself faster. Okay. So you're lowering yourself in much less time, which means you can move faster. As a consequence, you're exposing yourself to a larger amount of force. Okay, we postulate from that force, or an awful lot of that force, is absorbed by A, the confidence that the knee wrap affords, because it feels more solid, but also by physically by the knee wrap itself absorbing that mechanical energy.
Well, I would also submit that proprioception is at play here as well. We know that the insertion and origination points of muscles have something, I want to say, is it called the Golgi?
Yeah, Golgi, yeah.
Okay, and this seems to provide feedback that we know when individuals use things like taping muscles at the insertion or the origination, they are able to move faster, and I suspect it's because the sensors in these areas of soft tissue are getting information that says, hey, this weight is not as heavy as we thought. What do you think about that?
I think you've got some merit there. I'd also suggest that it's probably less subtle than that, in as much as there's a physical barrier there.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
If you fit wraps properly, you know, powerlifting knee wraps properly, you can't escape the fact that they're there.
Yes, and they do. You know? And, you know, we were just talking about this morning. We were watching some guys bench press at the gym today. And the entire time this one guy was bench pressing, his friend had his hands on the bar standing over him. Yeah. And there's an old saying in the gym called magic fingers. Absolutely. You know, you can get into a position with a bench press and be completely stalled. And then someone just touches the bottom of the bar, applies very little force, but this minuscule amount of weight that they are, whether it's ounces that they are actually taking on themselves, allows you to push the weight. And so in the case of knee wraps, we know that tissue leverage when you wear suits has a role in acquiring greater force for power lifters. I have to believe that the knee wraps have some of the same effect as magic fingers, in that little bit of restriction that makes the knee want to straighten back out aids the lifter in being able to develop more force.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I think it really has to be a combination.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's
absolutely
no way around it. The bottom line is, I can't say at 100% confidence that it was all down to the knee wrap absorbing mechanical energy, because we didn't measure that.
Right.
You know, but I can say with a fair bit of confidence that it definitely absorbed a certain amount of force.
Okay. Here's what I want to do. Hold that thought. I'm sorry.
We
have to take a break. We're going a little long here. When we come back, I want to pick up on the balance of what you were just about to say. So hold your thought. And then I also want to talk about the bar, how it traveled differently with and without knee wraps. We're talking with Dr. Jason Lake, Department of Sports and Exercise Sciences at the University of Chichester in the UK, about how knee wraps affect back squatting. I think I'm going to start using knee wraps. I've never worn a pair. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
You train hard. You push the limits of your body every day, and sometimes pain pushes back. Now silence your pain with Phoenix Kinetocream. Kinetocream is made using a perfect blend of natural ingredients and reduces inflammation and shuts down pain with its very first use. Listen to what one user said about Phoenix Kinetocream.
Training made me ache. My back, my shoulders, even my elbows. I rubbed Kinetocream on my shoulders, and in minutes, I could feel the pain go away. Not covered up by that freezing feeling like other creams. The pain was gone.
You can learn more about Kinetocream by visiting PhoenixBioPerformance.com. Don't let pain slow you down. Rise above the ashes with Phoenix Kinetocream. That's PhoenixBioPerformance.com.
My friends are always asking me what I do to keep my face so youthful and fresh looking. I use RGCell Super Stem Cell Support. RGCell is the only cosmeceutical with penetrating anti-aging messenger molecules that activate old and dormant stem cells to restore your skin to a healthier, younger appearance. This helps to repair DNA, stimulate new cell growth, and aggressively eliminate wrinkles. You can learn more by visiting superhumanradio.com and clicking the RG Cell banner ad today.
Usually something for nothing is worth nothing, but go to superhumanradio.com and click the Life Extension banner ad to get a one-year Life Extension Foundation membership free, plus a $25 product credit. So what does that buy you? Cutting-edge information, knowledgeable health advisors, huge discounts on blood tests and supplements. Want to stay younger and healthier longer? Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Life Extension banner ad and become a Life Extension member now. No cost, no obligation, no kidding.
AnabolicMinds.com is the premier website for credible information on building muscle, burning fat, supplementation, and more. With over 100,000 active registered members and over 2.5 million posts, it's one of the largest communities on the internet to get help and answers to your question. It's also the place that the official Superhuman Radio Forum is hosted. Visit AnabolicMinds.com today and get into the action. AnabolicMinds.com. Learn. Teach. Lead.
My friends are always asking me what I do to keep my face so youthful and fresh looking. I use RGCell Super Stem Cell Support. RGCell is the only cosmeceutical with penetrating anti-aging messenger molecules that activate old and dormant stem cells to restore your skin to a healthier, younger appearance. This helps to repair DNA, stimulate new cell growth, and aggressively eliminate wrinkles. You can learn more by visiting superhumanradio.com and clicking the RGCell sell banner ad today.
Whey Natural USA is the best whey protein in the world. Not only is it from Amish grass-fed cows inside the United States, but it's the only grass-fed whey in the world that is not heat pasteurized. Don't be fooled by other grass-fed whey products that are low heat pasteurized. Only the patented Chill-Rite process leaves all the natural fractions of whey intact to boost your immune system while building more muscle. And Whey Natural USA is also the lowest price for non-heat pasteurized grass-fed whey protein in the world. Don't waste your time on products that only deliver 15 grams of protein per scoop. Choose the best with 25 grams of protein per scoop. Whey Natural USA. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Whey Natural USA banner ad today to see why anything less is wasting your money.
Listen strong. It's Superhuman Radio.
Yeah, this one right here goes out to all the babies, mamas.
Welcome back.
Mamas. Baby mamas.
We're talking with Dr. Jason Lake about how wearing knee wraps affect back squat performance. Okay, so I interrupted you as we were going into the break. Did you want to contribute some more on that portion of the discussion?
All I really wanted to add to that was that we were talking about, you know, how I couldn't really be 100% sure that the knee wrap actually absorbed any mechanical energy. The only sort of insight I could provide to that, however, was that when we essentially tried to establish how much force you needed to apply to the band to stretch it fully, we were essentially recording something in the region of 450 newtons of force, which is roughly equivalent to the sort of force it's going to take to move a 45-kilo plate.
Well, I'll tell you something that is anecdotal in that vein, and that is when you talk to powerlifters who are really big benchers, you know, the guys that are benching 600, 700, 800 pounds, and the shirts that they wear are designed for that type of lift. And they will tell you that when they unrack the weight, they must pull the weight down to their chest. It doesn't come down on its own. So that tells you something about the compaction of flesh inside that tube of material and the tissue leverages and its resistance to want to bend.
Absolutely.
So that may play a role.
That definitely gives us some insight into, and I think it really helps us illustrate just what this equipment actually is, because I think unless you've experienced it or been around people who use it, you can't quite comprehend what it actually does.
Okay, let's talk more now about what else you learned. What about bar travel, the horizontal plane in which the bar went from top to bottom and back up to top again?
Okay, well, like any good scientist, you really should be approaching any sort of study with an open mind. However, I didn't. I had certain preconceptions about this thing, and I was anticipating that when knee wraps were worn, even by people who were relatively sort of comfortable wearing them, that it would tip them forward. However, what we found was, and we were going to measure the tipping forward effect, if you like, by looking at the horizontal travel of the barbell, how far it moved forwards and backwards. As it turned out, it actually helped maintain a tighter barbell trajectory. And what I mean by that is there was less movement, but B, the down pattern and the up pattern were more closely matched, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Is that not just the effects of resisting or restricting the cantilever effect of the knee? The knee, I have to believe that a lot of the early movement in a non-knee wrapped lifter versus the knee wrapped lifter looks more like a scissor jack in the non-knee wrapped lifter. And in the knee wrapped lifter, I have to believe that the hamstrings and buttocks muscles and lower back are doing a lot more early on because the knee is resistant to breaking and bending.
I think you're absolutely right. I think what it shows us is to take your point, a stage further, you actively have to, and going back to your earlier example of the bench shirt, you have to actively pull down.
Yeah.
You do that with your backside.
And that would make sense because if you think of the lifter and the bar on his back or on the upper portion of his traps, and he's not knee wrapped and he's literally sitting back with the bar is going to have greater horizontal travel. But if he's not sitting back with the bar, but instead bending at the hips to come down initially, the bar is going to have more vertical travel than horizontal travel early on, which could never be recompensated for at the bottom of the movement when the knees finally break. So I have to believe it's a virtually different squat entirely.
Absolutely, and that's what our graphs show us. I mean, the graphs that we presented in the paper show that pretty much, a completely different down pattern to the up pattern during unwrapped squatting, whereas the wrapped squatting, it was a far, I mean, a simple way of describing it would be that when you wear knee wraps, the movement has to be more deliberate. Otherwise it goes wrong.
Was there an overall increase in force generated with knee wraps versus without?
Yes.
What was it?
I've got the numbers in front of me. Now, the lifting, what we call, we basically measured impulse. So this is the amount of force applied over a period of time. And there was a 10% difference. So wrapped squat performance allowed or facilitated 10% more impulse than unwrapped.
Would that translate directly to a 10% increase in weight managed in a lift? So theoretically, a lifter whose top weight raw is 400 pounds could potentially squat 440 wearing wraps?
Not necessarily, but what it does show us is that they were able to move, or they were able to generate 10% more power. So they were able to move 10% faster, essentially.
Okay, now, the $64 million question, most people wear knee wraps because they claim they protect the knee. I have stayed away from knee wraps because my concern is that they would force an exaggerated separation of the knee joint and actually compromise the knee. Were you able to ascertain anything from this study that would indicate whether knee wraps protect the knee or potentially could hurt the knee?
Bottom line is no, we didn't take any measures that would quantify that. So all I've really got to go on is the couple of papers that are essentially review papers. And it was the fact that there were only these review papers back almost 20 years ago, some of them, that essentially stimulated our research interest. They suggest that wearing knee wraps can really compromise the integrity of the knee joint by essentially separating or forcing the knee joint to separate. However, no one's actually measured that.
That's my fear. That's why I've never used knee wraps, because I already have an ACL missing from my left leg from a 30-year-old skiing accident where bindings didn't come off. And the last thing I want to do is start separating the knee joint itself, because I don't want to end up with bucket handle tears, meniscus shifting, and so on and so forth. So I have just instinctively stayed away from knee wraps for that reason.
Hmm. So. I mean, I really think it comes down to what are your goals. If it's to compete in powerlifting and to compete in equipped powerlifting, so to lift the absolute maximum you can lift, there's probably not going to be any getting away from the fact that you're going to have to wear knee wraps at some point.
Yeah. Well, 20 years ago, I would have said, yes, my goals are exclusively power, but at 54 years old, I want to maintain to try to minimize the wear and tear on my body until I can figure out how to replace parts. Thanks to Dr. Aubrey de Grey there in the UK, who's working on nanotechnology now. So there you go.
No, absolutely. I mean, yeah, absolutely. But I mean, I think that doesn't necessarily mean you shouldn't try them. I think it just applies to anything new. You just have to be careful.
Yeah.
Be sensible. You know, and if it does start to bother you, then you back off, because what people have suggested probably is true then.
Yeah.
Because we don't know that for sure, there's no reason why you shouldn't try it, as long as you take it, you know, use a sensible approach.
And also, wrapping knees is an art, and you should really learn from somebody who knows how to wrap them, because you can really cause some damage. You can restrict blood flow. You could cause a lot of trouble. So you need to get somebody who knows how to wrap knees, that's done it before, to wrap them for
you
the first time.
Don't try and second guess how you're supposed to do it. No.
Yeah. All right. Listen, we have about 5 minutes left in this interview. So you alluded to off the air that your group is working on some kettlebell research now.
Yeah, we've been doing a fair bit with kettlebells recently. I mean, I say a fair bit. We've recently had two studies published, both in the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research, and both, in my opinion, quite exciting. And it's something we're continuing to work with. So, yeah, absolutely. This is one of my sort of main interests, of many, I suppose.
And what have you learned about kettlebell training in general? Obviously, you're probably training the most basic movements, like the kettlebell swing.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the kettlebell swing so far has been our main sort of area of research. And more specifically, it's been the two-handed kettlebell swing, using the hard style technique popularized by Pavel.
Right.
And If I'm absolutely honest with you, this is one of those things that I train with kettlebells a lot. I enjoy them, and I know I'm getting something out of them, although obviously I hadn't quantified them. And I'd read quite a few tidbits on the internet and even a few published reviews that sort of suggested that kettlebells couldn't possibly have any training benefit to strength or power because the loads were too light.
Right.
So I thought, well, there's only one way to really find this out, isn't there? And that's to actually study the movements. So we studied them. We used a very similar approach. We recorded motion of the kettlebell. We recorded ground reaction forces, so how hard we were pushing against the ground, how much power was being generated. And then we compared that to back squats and jump squats with different loads.
Mm-hmm.
And power output, so the highest power you could generate in a given movement, was essentially maximized in both jump squat and kettlebell swing exercise with 32 kilograms. There was no significant difference.
Wow.
More importantly, the impulse, so the amount of force applied over a period of time, was greatest during the kettlebell swing with 32 kilograms.
So, what would people take away from this information about kettlebell training, especially the kettlebell swing? What does this apply to? Would it be a better movement to choose if you only had one thing that you could do in a given day?
I think if you only have one thing to do, I think the potential for more bang for your buck training probably lies in the kettlebell swing. Now, I'm not going to try and say that, you know, everybody should stop back squatting, they should stop their traditional power training and just replace everything with a kettlebell, because that would be silly, because we know all the other stuff works. However, I think what this shows us is there's definitely a place for kettlebell swing training in traditional strength and conditioning programs.
The problem with the kettlebell swing is that people don't do it right when I see them at the gym. They're actually
Absolutely.
Lifting with their arms and their shoulders to get the kettlebell to reach the top point of the arc. And you really, the arms are supposed to be more like a pendulum. Mm-hmm. And the force of the push from the squat up to the standing position is supposed to propel or catapult the kettlebell up. And after you do three or four reps, this momentum increases. The arms are just supposed to hold on to the kettlebell. You're not supposed to be lifting like you're doing
Absolutely.
Some sort of front deltoid
movement. I would say that we probably need to emphasize that we're not aiming to move the kettlebell up. We're aiming to move the kettlebell forward.
Yes.
So we're trying to project it forwards.
And at the bottom, the kettlebell should actually be beneath your bum at the very, very bottom. It should not be
Absolutely.
In front of you.
And we should be minimizing the squat. It should be based around hip flexion.
Yes.
So driving your backside back and then driving it forward.
Yeah.
Hey, keeping a good, strong, you know, trunk.
This is good research that you guys are doing over there. I really applaud you. And especially the knee wrap research. I love this. And you know what? I may have to have a second opinion about knee wraps. Maybe I'll try them sometime. Who knows?
Well, silly not to.
Listen, Dr. Lake, thanks so much. I know you guys are busy there preparing for spring break, and this was difficult for you to do this interview. Thank you so much for coming on the air with us.
No problem at all.
Take care.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
All right, so stay tuned. When we come back, we will be joined by Dr. Casey Vickers from Vanderbilt University to talk about the difference between cholesterol and HDL cholesterol. And should we divorce the two? Separate them? Do they mean something different? Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Superhuman Radio.
USA is the best whey protein in the world. Not only is it from Amish grass-fed cows inside the United States, but it's the only grass-fed whey in the world that is not heat pasteurized. Don't be fooled by other grass-fed whey products that are low heat pasteurized. Only the patented Chill-Rite process leaves all the natural fractions of whey intact to boost your immune system while building more muscle. And Whey Natural USA is also the lowest price for non-heat pasteurized grass-fed whey protein in the world. Don't waste your time on products that only deliver 15 grams of protein per scoop. Choose the best with 25 grams of protein per scoop. Whey Natural USA. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Whey Natural USA banner ad today to see why anything less is wasting your money.
Have you ever been let down by so-called nitric oxide muscle pump products before?
Well, prepare to be shocked. Vengeance is like nothing you've ever tried before. Vengeance leverages several different scientifically proven technologies to deliver what some users say are painfully explosive pumps. If you are satisfied with nitric oxide products that make you wonder if they're working, move on. But if you want a muscle pump that you'll not only feel, but others will see, train with a vengeance. Go to xfmuscle.com today and get vengeance. Usually something for nothing is worth nothing, but go to superhumanradio.com and click the Life Extension banner ad to get a one-year Life Extension Foundation membership free, plus a $25 product credit. So what does that buy you? Cutting-edge information, knowledgeable health advisors, huge discounts on blood tests and supplements. Want to stay younger and healthier longer? Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Life Extension banner ad and become a Life Extension member now. No cost, no obligation, no kidding. Everyone wants growth hormone because growth hormone works. Now AgeForce is offering a buy one, get one free on their most popular transdermal patch. The Power Patch contains 25 milligrams of real somatropin per patch. It delivers real, competent human growth hormone right to your bloodstream without the discomfort of injections. There's never been a better time to see what the Power Patch can do for you. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the AgeForce banner ad today. This offer ends soon. Get your growth hormone the AgeForce way. Power Patch.
Orbit Nutrition carries over 1,000 of the hottest nutritional supplements, performance enhancers, and nutraceuticals on the planet. And now, Superhuman Radio listeners get an additional 5% off their everyday low prices by using the coupon code SHR5. That's SHR and the number 5. Choose from products like Quest Protein Bars, iForce Nutrition, Iron Mag Labs, and more. Check out Orbit's daily deals for special insane blowout prices. Log on to the Orbit Nutrition Forum and get feedback about the products you're shopping for, and get an additional 5% off using the coupon code SHR5. Orbit Nutrition. Fast, reliable, competitive, international. Why shop anywhere else?
Calling all men.
The Men's Stack is here from Muscle Gauge Nutrition. The Men's Stack will give you the energy you need to train harder and the materials you need to build new muscle. The Men's Stack includes American Protein Isolate, Stimulant-Free Pre-Workout Alpha Rage, Muscle Pump Activator, L-Arginine, AKG, and Multivitamin Plus Minerals specifically formulated for men. Now, Superhuman Radio listeners can get this Men's Stack for just $99 and free shipping while supplies last. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Muscle Gauge banner ad today.
Your radio just got ripped. It's Superhuman Radio.
We've come a long way in the story about cholesterol since Dr. Ansel Keys first imposed his theory that cholesterol levels were associated with atherosclerosis and other cardiovascular risk factors. We're learning more and more about cholesterol every single day. And perhaps it's not the demon we once thought it was. My next guest from Vanderbilt University School of Medicine is Dr. Casey Vickers. How are you doing, Casey?
I'm doing well, thank you.
I love the title, by the way. You know, you really caught me with this one because when I first read the embargoed press release on this, I thought there was some relationship between people who've been divorced and cholesterol levels. I was like, oh, damn, I got to read this because I went through a terrible divorce. But I think it was very, very cool what you did. So
there might be something to the divorce angle.
Yeah.
We originally had the title before we actually had the paper as a concept. Usually we had the paper before we come up with the title. And we were just kind of kicking it around between different investigators. And we kept the title, and then the reviewers asked us to change the title, and then it looks like they decided to go back to the original title and keep the enticing.
Yeah, no, it definitely entices people to read it. But I got to tell you, it's more important. You know, we're learning every day that cholesterol is a meaningful, important contributor to health and longevity. University of Hawaii did two great studies looking at cholesterol levels in general and longevity. There's so much. There's one camp that says, you know, lowering cholesterol is important regardless of what you lower. They treat HDL, LDL, everything the same. And then there's other camps that say, wait a minute, we need to start looking at this particle size. We need to start looking at this. This may not be so bad and so on. So what your group did was you did a meta-analysis, correct?
That's correct.
And what studies did you look at for your meta-analysis, and what did they have to have in the study in order to be selected?
Well, we didn't take more of a hardcore data meta-analysis. We essentially wanted to go back and historically look at the literature about other cargo on HDL. And so we initially started with the idea that there's a need now to rebrand HDL, that simply lowering or raising HDL cholesterol levels does not, well, the clinical trials have now showed us that that might not be the best approach to reduce cardiovascular outcomes or events. However, we still believe in a HDL hypothesis. We think that HDL is a wonderful particle, very beneficial to a variety of processes outside of just removing cholesterol or excess cholesterol from the peripheral tissues back to the liver. It has numerous properties that we study. For instance, its anti-inflammatory properties, its antioxidative properties. When it bumps into cells, it not only activates numerous transcription factors and downstream gene expression changes that are beneficial to the cell as well as the system. We're now realizing it has all sorts of unique cargo that we never appreciated, such as a whole diversity of vitamins, steroids, and hormones, mm-hmm. As well as small RNAs, microRNAs, and some of these other reactive lipids that we're now appreciating to be beneficial to the system.
So what is the problem? There is a high density lipoprotein, and then there is high HDL cholesterol. For those of us who are not clear on what the difference is, explain it, please.
Okay, yeah. So for the last half century, for the last 50 years, they're one and the same. So when people refer to HDL, they're mainly referring to HDL cholesterol. So when you measure cholesterol in the HDL fraction, you're actually measuring the amount of cholesterol, either free cholesterol or cholesterol ester, in that particular HDL lipoprotein fraction. So what we know by HDL historically has been through isolating or floating HDL through density gradient ultracentrifugation, essentially just measuring the amount of cholesterol in that particular fraction that corresponds to HDL. But we now realize that we need to pay more attention to the actual number of HDL particles. So HDL cholesterol just tells us how much cholesterol is carried by the HDL compartment.
Mm-hmm.
But we now realize it's a number of HDL particles that is most likely beneficial. And there's actually, we can't completely rule out the cholesterol study. Dan Rader's group at University of Pennsylvania showed that the cholesterol efflux capacity, or the ability of the HDL to accept cholesterol from macrophages in the periphery,
mm-hmm.
is a better marker for, even better than HDL cholesterol levels, as being have an inverse relationship to cardiovascular risk.
Really? And that makes sense, because macrophages are responsible for ridding us of metabolic waste and debris, right?
Right. So essentially, so whether you use a CETP inhibitor or use niacin, these clinical trials that aimed at raising HDL cholesterol levels, they not necessarily increase the number of HDL particles or increase the potential of HDL to remove the cholesterol from the peripheral tissues or from macrophages.
So what does promote the HDL's ability to take on the waste cargo from macrophages and do a better job, if just raising HDL by itself doesn't seem to impact?
Right, that's a fantastic question. So HDL is a dynamic particle. So it starts out as a small nascent HDL particle, discoidal particle. Then as it gains lipid and cholesterol through the actions of ABCA1. So ABCA1 is a transporter, a cholesterol transporter on hepatocytes in the liver as well as in macrophages. And it transports excess cholesterol from the cell to small HDL, so lipid-poor or lipid-free ApoA1. Now HDL gains its cholesterol and becomes more spherical and larger, and it has is more cholesterol-rich. And so we think that the smaller HDL has more potential, and it's just a matter of space, that the small HDL has more potential to accept the cholesterol from the periphery or from the cholesterol loaded macrophage.
Interesting. Okay, so your group wants to get clinicians to start paying attention not to HDL cholesterol, but to the size of the HDL lipoprotein itself, right?
Well, I think more important than size is just number. I think so. You're right. We think that the small HDL has carries a lot of the alternative functions of HDL, mm-hmm. as well as maybe having the most potential to accept cholesterol from the macrophages. It's not to say that large HDL can't accept cholesterol. It certainly can. But there, we still have a lot to learn about the differences between the small and the large HDL in terms of its acceptance of cholesterol.
Is the small HDL, is the small HDL made that way, or does small HDL have the ability to become large, and does large have the ability to become small?
Yes, you're right. It's dynamic in that nature. So as HDL delivers cholesterol to other cells and back to the liver, for catabolism, HDL delivers its contents to a process called selective core uptake, where mainly SRB1, which is scavenger receptor B1, interacts with the HDL particle and brings in the core contents of HDL. So unlike LDL receptor, which takes up the LDL particle,
right,
through a process called receptor-mediated endocytosis and brings it into the cell, HDL is not taken up into the cell. Now, there is some evidence of a, what we call a holoparticle uptake, where the HDL could be taken up into the cell, but for the most part, HDL remains on the surface of the cell, and the cell just kind of takes the core contents of HDL. So as HDL delivers its core contents, it shrinks in size, and then it's able to go back and pick up more cholesterol. And it's a dynamic nature.
You know, so not to veer away from the whole HDL, but you just said something that intrigued me. The fact that LDL is picked up and brought into the cell implies that the cell has to execute and use some form of energy to do so. And we know that when cells use energy to bring things in, oxidation occurs. Could that be why LDL causes problems? Because of the mechanism in which it migrates into the cell?
Well, there might be something to that. I think the reason LDL causes problems is because its ability to be modified and oxidized and increase its residency time and thus the accumulation of lipid and fat and cholesterol in the arterial wall, which initiates a whole series of inflammatory cascades.
And right.
So, you know, atherosclerosis and arteriosclerosis, this is an inflammatory disease.
Right.
That's initiated by the accumulation of fat and lipid. And, of course, it cycles on itself.
But is it really initiated by the accumulation of fat and lipids? See, that's the part that I don't understand, and I'll tell you why.
Because
there's so many good studies out there that show that elderly people with high cholesterol who live very long lives and don't have any indication of arteriosclerosis. And so it makes you ask yourself, well, wait a minute, because the analogy I've been using on the show for a very long time is, look, if I come into your home and I punch a hole in the wall and you spackle it,
right?
What was the problem? The spackle or me punching the hole? Well, it's me punching the hole. The spackle was a necessary repair mechanism. So is it really the fat that's causing the inflammation, or is it something else and the fat is just doing its job?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a couple of sides to this story. I think, you know, atherosclerosis, like I mentioned, is an inflammatory disease. And whether you have, for instance, if you have damage to the endothelium or you have areas where you have disturbed flow, natural flow of the blood, you can have areas where the endothelial barrier is not as complete or the integrity of it, and therefore you start to have lipoproteins and LDL kind of migrate into the subendothelial space, and then it starts off a series of inflammatory response and accumulation.
For lack of better terms, tear. Fissure that's caused by inflammation has to be there in order for that piece of cholesterol to get caught underneath there in the first place, right?
Yes, I agree. I think that there probably are a couple of examples where you could have inflammation being an initial nucleus or stimulation for the arteriosclerosis, and then that, of course, once you have that, you start to have damage to the endothelium, and then you could have the accumulation of lipid and cholesterol. But for the most part, we seem to think that, you know, it's cholesterol or fat accumulation, these modified lipoproteins that are binding the proteoglycans and things, collagen, that are then a series of inflammatory cascades that then bring in more lipoproteins and more inflammatory cells.
Sure, so, yeah, and it becomes a vicious cycle once it starts.
I want to comment on the cholesterol hypothesis.
Yes, please.
I don't think the cholesterol hypothesis is dead by any means. I mean, the number one predictor of cardiovascular disease is still LDL cholesterol. But you're right. Some people come into the cath lab and present with cardiovascular events that have normal cholesterol levels. And as you mentioned, the elderly lady, that some people have high cholesterol or hypercholesterolemia for their entire lives in their absence of cardiovascular disease. So while the cholesterol hypothesis is not foolproof, and everyone can find arguments, you know, for both sides, there are numerous clinical trials and evidence that suggest that there is a benefit for lowering LDL cholesterol.
But only when it's radically high. My problem right now is that there's a move amongst the medical orthodoxy driven by the pharmaceutical agenda to start using statin drugs as a prophylactic. And they're wanting to give it to people who don't have high cholesterol so that they never get high cholesterol. And I think that this is really dangerous because, as you're finding out, some fractions of cholesterol are very important. And I have to believe that while high HDL levels do not tell the whole story that we thought they did once, because you're showing that, hey, it's not high HDL by itself, but it's this form of HDL, these smaller particle size and numbers of these smaller particle sizes that are important. I have to believe that when you do have higher HDL, you are at least in a position to have the precursors for that dynamic transference to the type of HDL that we want to see. But now where the magic is how do we increase the proliferation? And I want to touch base on that when we come back. And then we have a question from Adele Musa, who's a contributor to the show and will be on during the second hour, has a question about LDL all the way from Munster, Germany. We're talking right now, to Dr. Casey Vickers from Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. We're talking about cholesterol. The discussion becomes more complex, as most things are. It's not simple. It's not black and white. We're learning more and more about cholesterol every single day. It may not be the demon that we once thought. It may have a demon brother, but not all cholesterol is potentially bad. So let's listen to the rest of the interview when we come back from the break. Stay tuned.
Dessert again with the new 100% natural line of high-protein, low-carb Quest protein bars. I love lemon cream pie and strawberry cheesecake, but you can choose from chocolate peanut butter, coconut cashew, or cinnamon roll as well. No matter which one you try, you'll feel like you're eating dessert. But this is no ordinary dessert. With 20 grams of high-quality whey protein isolate, 17 grams of prebiotic fiber, and sweetened with stevia, these bars will make you feel like you're cheating, but you're not. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Quest Protein Bar banner ad to learn more about these clean and delicious protein bars.
There are a few products that I believe in the way I believe in CanSee eye drops. I've been using CanSee for 6 months now, and the changes in my vision are nothing short of amazing. My near vision has improved, and I can read small print from 8 inches. My overall vision is clearer, and the glare from oncoming headlights doesn't bother me any longer. Just 1 to 2 drops a day, and the results are visible. You can find CanSee eye drops at wisechoicemedicine.net or call 800-861-4936. That's 800-861-4936. WiseChoiceMedicine.net. CanSee Eye Drops. The name says it all.
This time of year, it seems everyone's sick. You need to do everything you can to avoid it. A healthy immune system starts with a healthy lifestyle. This includes Altrient C. Altrient C delivers the vitamin C your body needs. In fact, Altrient delivers 200% more vitamin C than pills or powders. Go to AltriantC.com. That's AltriantC.com. It even comes with a money-back guarantee. For vitamin C that actually gets absorbed, go to AltriantC.com or call 888-437-6353 to order. That's 888-437-6353. Altrient C. 21st century vitamin C.
Iron Mag Labs is the leading supplement company offering the most hardcore pro-anabolic supplements. Visit IronMagLabs.com and check out our top-selling products. Asta RX, Halo Extreme, Sinustain RX, E-Control RX, Decadrol Max, Ultramale RX. Iron Mag Labs makes supplements that actually work. No hype, no BS, just real results. There's a reason you keep hearing about Iron Mag Labs. Come see what you're missing. Visit Iron Mag Labs at IronMagLabs.com for the most hardcore bodybuilding supplements.
My friends are always asking me what I do to keep my face so youthful and fresh looking. I use RGCell Super Stem Cell Support. RGCell is the only cosmeceutical with penetrating anti-aging messenger molecules that activate old and dormant stem cells to restore your skin to a healthier, younger appearance. This helps to repair DNA, stimulate new cell growth, and aggressively eliminate wrinkles. You can learn more by visiting superhumanradio.com and clicking the RGCell banner ad today.
This time of year, it seems everyone's sick. You need to do everything you can to avoid it. A healthy immune system starts with a healthy lifestyle. This includes Altrian C. Altrian C delivers the vitamin C your body needs. In fact, Altrian delivers 200% more vitamin C than pills or powders. Go to AltrianC.com. That's AltrianC.com. It even comes with a money-back guarantee. For vitamin C that actually gets absorbed, go to AltriantC.com or call 888-437-6353 to order. That's 888-437-6353. Altriant C, 21st Century Vitamin C.
Jumping higher, lifting more. It's Superhuman Radio.
You ready? Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. We're talking with Dr. Casey Vickers about cholesterol. Not all HDL is created equal. Okay. Dr. Vickers, is there anything that we can do? Is there any evidence that things like exercise, for instance, or certain nutritive approaches either increase or decrease the proliferation of this small HDL fraction size and numbers?
Well, I mean, I'm not an MD. I'm a PhD. So I'm not giving medical advice here, but definitely exercise and eating a low cholesterol and a low fat diet will help your cardiovascular system and your lipoprotein profile. There's nothing specifically that we know of right now that will increase or directly increase the amount of small HDL as opposed to the large HDL. And we're just learning more about the differences between the small and the large HDL. And this is coinciding with in the last couple of years with just explosion of research into alternative functions of HDL, identifying how HDL is anti-apoptotic, how HDL has cytoprotection, is antiviral, it's anti-inflammatory and antioxidant, and has acute phase response and involved in vision. So there are all these numerous alternative functions of HDL, and we're trying to identify which small molecule or which component of HDL confers these alternative functions outside of cholesterol. And that was the kind of main point of this meta-analysis, is that if we step back and we have to rebrand HDL, that it might be a good time to acknowledge all the other things that are along for the ride on HDL in addition to cholesterol.
Okay, now this question comes from Adele Musa, who's a contributor to the show, and he says... Sure. Can you ask your guest whether this new perspective on HDL would not also change our perception of LDL, and whether this would not tell us that the liver produces more LDL in an effort to get certain nutrients out to the peripheral organs?
Right. That's a great point. So very much like HDL, LDL also carries specific proteins and lipids. We generally think of HDL being more of a protein scaffold and carrying a more diverse set of proteins than LDL. LDL obviously is a larger particle, so it has more lipids, and with more lipids, there's more of a chance for oxidation and bioactive lipids. And we know in my personal lab studies HDL microRNAs, and we know that both HDL and LDL contain microRNAs. However, HDL has more microRNAs, and if you treat cells with either the same concentrations of LDL and HDL, it's the HDL that has the ability to deliver these microRNAs to recipient cells. And so while LDL has some of these components that HDL has, we have not elevated LDL to the level of HDL as being this general transporter of cargo. And that probably has a lot to do with how the HDL delivers its contents and cargo to the cells, where LDL has to deliver its cargo through the lysosome and the LDL receptor pathway, which is very acidic and potentially could damage some of these either signaling molecules or some of these beneficial things such as hormones and vitamins.
We have a lot of clinicians that listen to the show, lots of doctors, lots of scientists. And what do you hope that they take away from this initial research?
I hope that they're not discouraged by these clinical trials aimed at raising HDL cholesterol and realize that the goal is essentially to raise the HDL particle number and raise the beneficial types of HDL. And what I mean by beneficial types of HDL, if we could figure out a way to raise the HDL that has the greatest potential to remove cholesterol from the periphery, then that would be a therapeutic goal. I think that if we, and I know that some studies now are going back and looking at these large clinical trials and looking at HDL particle number. In fact, HDL particle number is a better indicator than HDL cholesterol levels for instance, the odds ratio and the inverse relationship to cardiovascular disease. So I think that it's important not to give up on HDL, not to get discouraged, and kind of stay with the HDL biology and that, and be supported by the fact that we're learning so many alternative functions of HDL, so many benefits that we never knew that HDL conferred. But so really, it's increasing the HDL particle number, increasing the ability to efflux cholesterol from the periphery. And then as we learn more about these specific microRNAs and small RNAs and these other hormones and vitamins on HDL, maybe there are certain subclasses of HDL that we need to aim in the future to raise those particular individual classes of HDL.
You know, you'll probably get an appreciation. Earlier in the week, we did a show with an anthropologist who looked at 4 million years of arteriosclerosis.
Wow.
And they looked at four or five different population civilizations, you know, from around the world where they used mummification as part of their burial process and were able to find evidence of serious, I mean, the kind of coronary plaque that we see today
right.
in people up to 4 million years ago. So this right. is something that is not, you know, we like to believe that it's a modern disease. I mean, even I like to believe that it's a modern. I like to right. think that, oh, no, our ancestors didn't have this. This is something that we can figure out and correct. Well, apparently not. You know, so I think this is one area of science that I feel like we can do better right. than perhaps, you know, our ancestors did. Let's put it that
way.
Well,
I think that's a very interesting argument and discussion is that, you know, the evolutionary pressure was not placed on cardiovascular disease up until, you know, the last few generations simply because people were dying at such a young age and that they weren't able to
right.
acquire this end-stage cardiovascular disease. And so there's very little evolutionary pressure. And so a lot of the mechanisms that we have today are probably, you know, ancient mechanisms and not necessarily just in the histology and the pathology that the anthropologist was discussing, but actually the molecular biology and some of the mechanisms are still at play.
But see, you know, my whole problem with this is, but I believe, I am sincerely a devout believer in that nature and the body is perfect and that we get it wrong. In other words, the things we expose ourselves to, the foods that we eat, the lifestyles that we live, we're not designed to do these things. So whenever something happens, I always say to myself, what is the body trying to do? Why is it doing this? It's doing it for a reason. It doesn't do anything by accident. We know this.
Right.
So when we develop plaque, I'm saying to myself, if we've been doing this for 4 million years, what flipping wrong thing are we doing that we can't figure out that we shouldn't be doing? Because the body is developing plaque. It doesn't right. want to. It's like, you're making me do this. Would you just stop it? You know? And it's like, well, it frustrates
right.
me.
Well, we've been on a high meat, you know, milk diet for, you know, for centuries. You know, with the early humans probably were eating a diet high. I mean, I'm not a nutritionist or anthropologist.
Nah, it's not that. And I'll tell you why. And no disrespect. I mean, the work that you're doing is fantastic. But the quality of meat that we eat today is the problem. When we were eating ruminant animals that were grass-fed, grass-finished, they were eating natural diets, they have the same omega-3 to omega-6 ratios as salmon. Mm-hmm. So the whole meat equals inflammation equals all these problems, that's relatively new. That's because of factory farming and artificial diets that these animals are eating. But, you know, there's something else. There's something else that we were exposed. Because I even asked this anthropologist, is there any evidence that these societies, there was one hunter-gatherer group that they looked at, but there was only three samples, mummies for them to look at in that particular group. I said, well, all of these grain-based groups, and, you know, all but one, the hunter-gatherers were not, and they had plaque as well. And I'm thinking there's got to be something else that there. You see, I believe, and I know that I'm an idiot because I have no certifications in anything except this show, but I just believe that when we eat things we're not supposed to eat, this is what goes on in our bodies. And I really believe that there's a lot of things that we eat today that are quote unquote alternative foods because in order to feed the masses, we can't eat what we're designed to eat. We have to eat what's available. And I keep coming back to the whole nutritional side of this for some reason, and I don't know why.
Well, we have a lot to learn. We have a lot to understand about the relationship between different types of diet, the diversities of diet, and the limitations of different foods we have on our cardiovascular systems in related to HDL function
right.
and HDL cholesterol levels.
I think you're doing great work. I hope that you can also unlock how we can increase the small particle HDL and its numbers so that we can all benefit from this. And maybe 4 million years from now, they'll go, hey, you know, plaque seemed to disappear right around 2014, 2015. It was just amazing. And I heard of this guy. They used to call him St. Casey Vickers. And he's the guy who found the answer. So there you go. Listen.
Well, I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for being on the show, Casey.
Yep. Anytime.
Take care.
All right. Thank you.
All right, so stay tuned. When we come back, we will be joined all the way from beautiful, sunny Munster, Germany, by Adele Musa as we perform the Subversity Science Roundup.
USA is the best whey protein in the world. Not only is it from Amish grass-fed cows inside the United States, but it's the only grass-fed whey in the world that is not heat pasteurized. Don't be fooled by other grass-fed whey products that are low heat pasteurized. Only the patented Chill-Rite process leaves all the natural fractions of whey intact to boost your immune system while building more muscle. And Whey Natural USA is also the lowest price for non-heat pasteurized grass-fed whey protein in the world. Don't waste your time on products that only deliver 15 grams of protein per scoop. Choose the best with 25 grams of protein per scoop. Whey Natural USA. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Whey Natural USA banner ad today to see why anything less is wasting your money. Superhuman Radio has the smartest and most dedicated health and fitness listeners found anywhere in the world. If you're trying to tap this market of greater than 50 million health fitness consumers, you simply can't do better than advertising on Superhuman Radio. Our sponsors tell us Superhuman Radio outperforms other forms of advertising time and time again. If you're tired of wasting valuable advertising dollars and need a new way to build your client base, go to superhumanradio.com and click on the Advertise with Us link. It just may be the best thing you have ever done for your business. Wherever you call your battlefield after each training engagement, you must recover. Introducing the most complete all-natural and organic recovery formula, and Nutrition's Basic Training, formulated by a military veteran. Basic Training provides the ammunition your body needs to recover and continue the fight. No fake sugar or flavors, no GMOs, less than 1 milligram of sugar and soy per serving, with complete nutrition no other company provides. Arm yourself with the healthiest recovery formula on the market, the body's ammunition. And Nutrition. Join the nutritional revolution by going to muscleandnutrition.com. That's muscle, AMNUTRITION.com.
Recover!
And Nutrition.
Calling all men.
The Men's Stack is here from Muscle Gauge Nutrition. The Men's Stack will give you the energy you need to train harder and the materials you need to build new muscle. The Men's Stack includes American Protein Isolate, Stimulant-Free Pre-Workout Alpha Rage, Muscle Pump Activator, L-Arginine, AKG, and Multivitamin Plus Minerals specifically formulated for men. Now, Superhuman Radio listeners can get this Men's Stack for just $99 and free shipping while supplies last. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Muscle Gauge banner ad today. New from Rob Ragish, author of The Blueprint and SHR's own Blueprint Power Hour, comes The Blueprint Bulletin. Every month, Rob delivers the absolute latest and greatest information right to your inbox. Everything's on the table, including training, diet, supplementation, gray market products, and more. This is a fantastic way to stay one step ahead of your competition and use these secrets to up your game. Go to theblueprintbulletin.com or click the Blueprint Bulletin banner ad on superhumanradio.com to get your free introductory issue. Go to theblueprintbulletin.com today. Everyone wants growth hormone because growth hormone works. Now Age Force is offering a buy one, get one free on their most popular transdermal patch. The power patch contains 25 milligrams of real somatropin per patch. It delivers real competent human growth hormone right to your bloodstream without the discomfort of injections. There's never been a better time to see what the power patch can do for you. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Age Force banner ad today. This offer ends soon. Get your growth hormone the H-Force way. Power patch.
This is the Superhuman Channel.
evolution just got kicked up a notch.
Welcome back. Welcome back to the Subversity Science Roundup, brought to you by Subversity.com, SUPPVERSITY.com. Go there and be smarter. Welcome, Adele Musa.
Hi, Colin.
So, Adele was listening to this last segment, and he actually sent that question, as all of you know. And he was also listening yesterday when we were talking to the cardiologist and the doctor of pharmacy about energy drinks. And Adele sent an interesting question that I forwarded on to the Dr. Riddick, and we'll probably have the answer tomorrow on Casual Friday. There is some linkage between something we did not talk about yesterday. We focused solely on the stimulants, the catecholamines, and these other agents. But all of these energy drinks have copious amounts of high fructose corn syrup, right, Adele?
Yeah, they do. And in fact, high fructose corn syrup, or large amounts of fructose, which hit your body in a short amount of time, they can actually deplete your liver of copper, because copper is obviously needed to to metabolize the fructose. And copper is also of major importance in terms of heart health and in terms of having a regular heartbeat. And therefore, I had the idea to ask the scientists whether they had considered this to be another factor in their findings, which were, by the way, about as interesting as most of the shows you've been airing recently.
Yeah, it's we'll have answers tomorrow from Dr. Riddick and on Casual Friday, but clearly Adele points out something that is an interesting phenomenon, and that is that high fructose corn syrup depletes copper. Copper is critical for stabilizing the rhythm of the heart. So these acute increases in QT interval can then actually be what's the word I'm looking for? Instigated or irritated even greater degree by the lack of available copper for the heart. So it's really an interesting discussion.
In rodent studies, we've already seen that that copper depleted rodents actually die when you administer high amounts of fructose because of arrhythmias and problems with the heart.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. And then earlier in the week, I messaged Adele early in the morning, and I said, you know, I have this suspicion that that intermittent fasting, while it has some really good things, can actually cause some problems if you are not strict about your diet. And what I suggested was, is it possible, I said, Adele, that when you fast, it not only increases insulin sensitivity, but also increases the insulinogenic response to the meal that you break the fast with. Because let's face it, the body doesn't know that you're fasting because you want to be lean and get on stage or drop body weight. The body thinks that you are starving for some reason. The environment is not providing sustenance for you to survive. So what is the body going to do with the meal immediately after a fast? It's going to store as much of it as fat if it has the opportunity to. And so the meal that you break the fast with and how you eat the rest of the day is very important. And the problem, the reason I even bring this up is because, like anything else that works, we have all of these idiots out there, like David Zizinko, who are writing books telling people, hey, if you just fast, you know, for half the day, you can eat crap the rest of the night and you'll lose weight. So what did you say to me, Adele, when I suggested this? You sent me a bunch of good studies, first of all, to read.
Well, I think the main message is that most people really overlook that intermittent fasting is still, for in the majority of cases, and especially in the scientific studies you have to support its efficacy, it's a tweak to reduce calorie intake. And I've only, you know, Johan Utterström, I hope I pronounce his name
correctly. Yeah, Utterström. Right.
Yeah, who's also a listener of the show, and he posted earlier today a video of a guy who proposes to fast 2 times per week and consume just 500 kilocalories on those days. And I responded that this will certainly work as long as you don't really overeat on the other days. And why does it work? Because if you do the calculation and assume that this guy would only need 2,000 calories per day, you would come out with a about 20% caloric deficit over the week. Right. And this is something people don't really look at, because they always think in terms of days, but you need to look at your caloric deficit over the week. And whenever you're dieting, whenever you're consuming less calories than you actually need. And I'm not talking just about looking at calories in versus calories out.
Right.
Because those variables actually depend on each other. You will burn less calories when you're starting to diet. So these are not independent variables, and therefore this equation does not work. But there is still a valid point made that you can consume less energy. I prefer the expression energy over calories, because calories is actually a concept our body does not know. So if you consume less energy than you actually need, you have much more leeway. And I already told that said that on last week to Adelfo that when he's starting to bulk, he will have to be much more careful about what he eats, because when the equation is equal, all of a sudden, when the quantity doesn't count anymore, or the deficiency, so to say, doesn't count anymore, the quality becomes all the more important.
Right. Right. And this is my fear. And my fear is, which we're going to talk about next, who's going to buy David Zinczenko's book? Starve yourself throughout the day and then eat anything you want at night. And don't forget, these people could easily eat 3,000 calories in a few hours that are left in the night, depending on what they are focusing on as their foods, because he's telling them, eat cake, eat pancakes, eat anything. It doesn't matter, as long as you're fasting during the day. Who's going to buy those books? Lean people aren't buying those books. Obese people are buying those books. So, Adele, you sent a study that shows that obese people respond differently to intermittent fasting, don't they?
Yeah, that's not really intermittent fasting, but it's a general study into the response, or into the differential response of obese versus lean people. And actually, I wouldn't have expected to see those differences, because although the obese people lost the same amount of weight when they literally starved for 48 hours, they did not really expose those beneficial, or did not really see those beneficial effects. For example, their insulin levels did not decrease. Hmm. Their leptin resistance was still the same, so they still had the really high leptin levels. They did not really see the same benefits in terms of reductions in inflammation. And overall, they also did not see the same risk of AMP kinase. So the bottom line of this study is actually that obese people are so deranged, or their metabolism is so deranged, that they don't have the metabolic flexibility which is necessary for intermittent fasting to work out. And you often hear this argument that our ancestors, they couldn't find food for a day, for example, but they were not obese. They were normal, so to say, normal weight, and they were metabolically flexible, and therefore different rules apply. So it is well possible that even if they don't totally binge in the evening, this will not work out the same way for someone who is obese as it would work out for someone who is lean. And you already mentioned that they can overeat on fast food and on cakes and etc. in the evening. One thing is that we see that, particularly in rodent studies, that this type of overcompensation does not happen when your satiety response is still intact. For example, if you put rodents on an intermittent fasting diet, they usually consume 40% less calories, although they could consume as much as they wanted in the time frame where they're exposed to the, or where they're actually fed. And in a healthy human being, who is eating just to satiety and not for different purposes, because let's be honest, we all eat because it's so tasty and we like to eat. And this is a particular problem for those people who already have weight problems. If this effect is not present, so the caloric, the energy reduction is not present, then the benefits of intermittent fasting are really they won't be so pronounced.
Right.
Or I would even go so far that to say that intermittent fasting on a bulk, where you deliberately eat more and try to scram that to pack all that into a very small fasting window, is certainly not going to result in greater lean mass increases.
Yeah. And so the takeaway is this. If you want to use fasting, it's a tool. It's like any other tool. It has a proper application and improper application. And right now, because people want to be told that, hey, you can eat crap and still get thin, that's what they want to be told. So yeah. Books like David Zizinko's book on intermittent fasting, and the book from the guy in the UK isn't so bad. He does make, I have to give him some props, the 500 calorie a day fast.
Yeah, and all the videos. So yeah. he's quite a smart guy. And
yeah.
He also says, he doesn't say eat whatever you want.
Yes.
He says keep your healthy diet and just fast on 2 days.
Yes.
And that's it. And this will work. Probably this will work.
Yes. And he is a believer that all calories are not the same. So unlike David Zizinko, who's pandering to the lowest common denominator and saying, hey, just fast in the morning and then you can come home and eat your Twinkies and pizza and pasta and everything else you want in that short window of time before you go to bed, and you'll lose weight. This is a bad message, and it's a horrible thing that he's doing to people, because a lot of people are going to be very dissatisfied, because guess what? It's not going to work. All right, let's do this. Let's take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, we'll pick it up. This is the Subversity Science Roundup with Adele Moussa. Visit Subversity.com, SUPPVERSITY.com today. We'll be right back.
You call your battlefield after each training engagement, you must recover. Introducing the most complete all-natural and organic recovery formula, and Nutrition's Basic Training, formulated by a military veteran. Basic Training provides the ammunition your body needs to recover and continue the fight. No fake sugar or flavors, no GMOs, less than 1 milligram of sugar and soy per serving, with complete nutrition no other company provides. Arm yourself with the healthiest recovery formula on the market, the body's ammunition, and Nutrition. Join the nutritional revolution by going to muscleandnutrition.com. That's muscle, AMNUTRITION.com.
Recover!
And Nutrition. Everyone wants growth hormone because growth hormone works. Now AgeForce is offering a buy one, get one free on their most popular transdermal patch. The Power Patch contains 25 milligrams of real somatropin per patch. It delivers real, competent human growth hormone right to your bloodstream without the discomfort of injections. There's never been a better time to see what the Power Patch can do for you. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the AgeForce banner ad today. This offer ends soon. Get your growth hormone the AgeForce way. Power Patch.
Never before has an anti-estrogen been so powerful. The triazole formula is built on a potent all-natural aromatase inhibitor called pizole, which has been shown in clinical trial to be as effective as a leading prescription aromatase inhibitor. Pizole works in concert with the rest of the triazole formula to control estrogen while simultaneously boosting testosterone significantly. In fact, one of triazole's testers had a 120% increase in total testosterone and a 257% increase in free testosterone. Triazole is available at bodybuilding.com, NutriPlanet.com, or where finer supplements are sold. For more information, check out GetDS.com.
AnabolicMinds.com is the premier website for credible information on building muscle, burning fat, supplementation, and more. With over 100,000 active registered members and over 2.5 million posts, it's one of the largest communities on the internet to get help and answers to your questions. It's also the place that the official Superhuman Radio Forum is hosted. Visit AnabolicMinds.com today and get into the action. AnabolicMinds.com. Learn. Teach. Lead.
I usually avoid protein bars because they're generally just candy in disguise. But that's all changed now. With Quest protein bars, we can enjoy dessert again without the guilt. With 20 grams of whey isolate protein, tons of prebiotic fiber, no sugar added, and only 2 to 6 grams of active carbohydrates per bar, Quest bars will keep you full and lean. I've never endorsed a protein bar before because I simply didn't trust them. That's all changed with the Quest bar. Not just because of what's in them, but more so for what's not. Go to superhumanradio.com today and click the Quest Protein Bar banner ad. Start enjoying dessert again.
True Protein is now TrueNutrition.com. The company that gave you personalized protein blends has now expanded their offerings to include over 5,000 new products. Whether your interests are health and fitness, sports nutrition and supplements, or fitness gear and accessories, you'll find what you're looking for at TrueNutrition.com. Check out the new vegetarian and vegan product lines as well. Oh, and don't worry, you can still blend your own personal protein supplements with a full range of milk, whey, casein, beef, egg, rice, and soy proteins. Check out TrueNutrition.com today.
Build muscle, burn fat. It's Superhuman Radio.
Take it back.
Sorry, I was just sucking some Altrian C out of a packet. I love this liposomal vitamin C. And the glutathione is great, too, but the new glutathione is going to be even better. The one that I'm taking right now, Adele, is a sulfur-based glutathione supplement. And so it smells a little bit, and Elisa doesn't even like the smell of it. She has to put it in water in order to take it and then drink the water down, and it's kind of in there like a capsule, if you will.
So. Can't be as bad as HMB.
Yeah. Okay. Sodium bicarbonate has been talked about as an ergogenic aid, and you dug up a new study that shows that it's a hell of an ergogenic aid. Why don't we talk about that first?
Yeah, actually, this is the second study for today, because people who've already been on the subversity and read today's article will have noticed that I also wrote about another study which also confirmed the ergogenic effects of sodium bicarbonate. But this one is actually pretty interesting because the effect size is really large. The eight trained male cyclists and triathletes they used as a subject in this particular study, they had an increase in time to exhaustion during a cycle test at high intensity of 23.5%, so about 25%, almost 25% increase in time to exhaustion. And this goes to show you that this is actually a supplement that's pretty damn cheap and that really works. And the dosage they used in the study is 0.3 grams per kilogram of body mass taken before the time trial. And usually you take it roughly an hour or 45 minutes before the time trial to get into an alkaline state, so to say. And this really counters the increase in acidity has on your performance and on your endurance performance in particular. And what is interesting is that this sounds like a supplement that's only interesting for people who are doing aerobics, but actually, it's also interesting for someone who would do a high-volume leg workout at a fast-paced intensity, for example, because this is also a kind of workout which really builds up or where you really reduce the bicarbonate stores in the blood, and therefore increasing them before the workout will have you end up at the end of the workout at normal levels. And wow, this can really amp up the performance during the workout.
Okay, but wait a minute. That's 30 grams of sodium bicarbonate for somebody like my size. Isn't that I mean, when I experimented with sodium bicarbonate, I may have told the story before, many years ago, I took a fairly large dose, went to the gym, and never got to train because I spent the rest of the time in the bathroom. So
yeah, exactly.
Isn't 30 grams going to cause some sort of bowel distress, some sort of gastric GI tract distress?
I'm wondering that in most of the studies, only one or two subjects get this gastric problems, and I'm not really sure we know why or who's particular susceptible to that. But I've been using it in the past, and I must say I'm not taking 30 grams because I don't have to maximize my performance absolutely on a single day, but I'm using it actually with every workout in lower dosages of, say, 5 to 8 grams. I don't really measure how much I'm taking. And in that case, you don't really get the problems in terms of your digestion and having to run to the toilet.
Okay, so how do you take it, Adele? Do you just take it with water?
I usually mix it when I'm consuming a pre-workout product. I usually mix it with that.
Okay.
But you got to be a little careful, because if you got something like citric acid or any other acid in it, then you get a nice soda, but you don't really get the sodium bicarbonate. So,
okay. So is this something that has an acute effect? In other words, can I use it just on the days that I'm going to do these high intensity workouts, or do I have to keep taking it every day in order to have blood levels stay stable?
Actually, this particular study says, or they even tested whether continuous supplementation would have an added benefit, but that's not the case. So the classic usage of sodium bicarbonate is when you have a contest or something like that. Then you use it on contest day to have real peak performance. But I personally feel that using lower dosages chronically really helps me to recover faster. And there is also one study which would confirm that you can reach the same effects by taking 3 or 5 grams, I think, over 5 days before the event, instead of using this large dosage directly before it. If you go to today's post and click on the link behind the word sodium bicarbonate to see all the posts I've hitherto posted on the subreddit, you can read up on that as well.
This is really intriguing. I think I'm going to start trying it again. Is it just sodium bicarbonate that you buy at the store, Arm & Hammer or whatever it is that happens to be out there? Is there some special type that you have to use?
No, it's just plain sodium bicarbonate. You just have to be careful, because some of those products are actually meant as an antacid, and they sometimes contain other stuff, like, for example, aluminum, and this is something you don't want to have in it.
Right.
So it must say that it's just NaHCO3, which is sodium bicarbonate and nothing else added. But in that case, you can basically use whatever you want. I've heard people say that they switched from one brand to another, and one tasted disgusting and the other was tolerable. And I must warn you, it does not really taste pleasantly. Although I personally feel when I mix it with something that's flavored, I don't really notice the taste. But if you go up to those 30 gram levels, you will certainly get a pretty salty taste. And maybe I should also add that I never had any issues with water retention, rather the opposite. And there are also studies showing that there is no or even a beneficial effect on blood pressure.
Okay, and then I guess the last question I have is there a way to test the acid / alkalinity, the pH of the body? Is testing your urine adequate if you have some pH strips, or should you prick your finger and test your blood?
Actually, you would really have to test your blood, but the acidity of the urine is the first indicator. So if your urine is constantly totally acidic, usually it should be somewhat acidic, because this keeps the keeps bacteria away. But if it's totally acidic, you could actually be in trouble, because there are also studies suggesting that acidity, or being in an acidic state constantly, has negative impacts on your whole metabolism, like reducing the metabolic, starting from reduced metabolic rate to insulin resistance, and ending up with cancer. So in general, this is something many people consider wiki-wacky science, and it's not really elucidated how and in how far you can actually...
Interesting.
I believe there is still much to be found out about being in the normal range, and it still will make a difference if you're on the lower end or the higher end of the normal range.
Right, right. Okay, so now let's change the subject just slightly. We'll stay with sodium bicarbonate, but in Europe it's very popular to drink mineral waters, and many of these mineral waters contain some form of sodium in a bicarbonate form, correct?
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
And so they did some research on postmenopausal women and found that it had some benefits if they would drink this type of mineral water.
Yeah, it really improved their insulin, or their their glucose metabolism, so to say. So the women were randomized to three groups. Two groups received a bicarbonated mineral water, and the other group just received plain table water without minerals or without bicarbonate in it. And then they measured their acute insulin response and glucose response to a meal, and they also measured their HbA1c after a certain time point. And what they found was that there was, for one of the mineral waters, improvements in these parameters were statistically highly significant. What was not so significant, interestingly, was the acute glucose response. But this, at least in my humble opinion, the way the insulin response developed, so to say, does tell you that there was a significant effect of the administration of or of consumption of these mineral waters, because in those groups who received the mineral waters, you see the regular insulin response with a spike in the beginning and a decline afterwards. And in the other group, these women who were already somewhat insulin resistant, you see what is typically a pre-stage of type 2 diabetes, where the initial spike is missing, and then there is a constant plateau, and the insulin levels keep elevated for a longer time period. And this is actually what you really want to avoid, because this is the pathway to type 2 diabetes. The initial spike is only a problem if you don't have anything or any place to store the glucose. And it's perfectly healthy, actually, to have this spike and appropriate, because the body knows when the glucose is floating around too long, it will cover all the cells. And this is actually what you measure with the HbA1c.
Right.
You measure how much glucose is attached to your blood cell. And this happens when insulin is not working, or when this initial spike is not working, and your blood glucose remains elevated for too long.
Interesting. And you know what? And to come full circle, when we talked to Dr. Kristen Beavers about how fat infiltrates muscle, one of the ways that fat infiltrates muscle is when you become diabetic or pre-diabetic. We see this in animals too. When they want an animal to get a lot of muscle fat, they just start feeding them corn, copious amounts of corn, day in and day out. And these animals, their blood sugar levels stay very, very elevated. They gain up to 3 pounds of fat a day, and 90% of it is intramuscular.
Yeah, and what's funny is that a group of scientists did that with athletes in order to increase their endurance performance.
Increase muscle fat.
Yeah, the carb load, this was a study which had the hypothesis that a huge carb load and a subsequent increase in intramuscular fat would increase the endurance performance, and it did, but not really significantly, and you can't really tell if it was the carb load or
right.
if it was due to the storage of fat in the muscle. But anyway, you don't really want that.
No,
at least not in the long term, and at least not, and especially not if you are not an athlete.
Okay, can we change subjects now?
First.
Okay, so let's talk about agility and how it may influence cognition, please.
Yeah, that's an interesting study, because it really pertains also to what you said before, to how in with respect to sporting, that much of our performance is also related to how well we can control our muscles. And on the other hand, agility exercises, which are those drills where you run from one side to the other, and where you all those small sprints and skill tests, so to say, where you really have to practice, not just, it's not like going down doing some push-ups, which everyone can do, but you really have to practice doing those skills and drills. That this in particular appears also to have a major impact on your cognitive performance.
Right.
And in this particular study, they had 41 subjects who were undergoing a military technical training, and one group did the traditional training, which consists of stuff like squats, bodyweight squats, and push-ups and sit-ups and all the things you know, also some sprinting. And the other group did this agility training, which was actually quite complex, and where they did very different drills, which became increasingly complicated. For example, after 3 weeks, they introduced a drill that was supposed to be done with two people standing next to each other, and one had to mirror exactly what the other did. So you really had to concentrate and to focus and look what the other does and then repeat exactly what he did. And this connection between the muscle and the brain also had a positive effect on cognitive tests that they did later. And those were cognitive reaction tests and listening tests and all sorts of other things which are very important for somebody who's working for the military.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. Okay, we have to take our next commercial break. And I should probably do some agility work during the break to improve my my cognitive ability. We're talking with Adel Moussa. This is the Subversity Science Roundup brought to you by Subversity.com. SUPPVRSITY.com. Go there. Impress your mother with how brilliant you are. We'll be right back. Let it come down slow, watch it all fly. Front to the back, then side to the side. Then we head back to my crib for the night. Thousands of Superhuman Radio listeners already know how well GLC 2000 works at repairing joints and cartilage, and it's the best price on the market, milligram for milligram. Now GLC Direct is offering a special that my listeners can take advantage of. Buy one, get one free of any GLC 2000 product. That's right. Buy one of your favorite GLC 2000 products and get one free. Capsules or raw powder. Just mention Superhuman Radio and buy one, get one free today. Call 866-452-3473 or click the GLC banner ad on superhumanradio.com. Offer limited to one per household. No other peptide supplier has a more complete offering than Southern Research Companies. And no other peptide supplier can boast that all their research peptides are manufactured inside the United States in Tier 1 labs. Whether you're looking for IGF-1 Long R3, GHRP6, GHRP2, Melanotan-2, Mechanical Growth Factor, or PT-141, or hard-to-find peptides like Triptorelin or Follistatin, you'll find them at Southern Research Companies. Free shipping on orders over $150. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Southern Research banner ad today and do business with the most trusted name in research peptides. Southern Research Company.
If you want to outlast, outmuscle, and outperform your competition with a high-powered, stimulant-free carbohydrate source that has zero sugars, you want Carbolin. Carbolin is the original high-performance fuel that will allow you to load your muscles with glycogen in minutes instead of hours. As a pre, intra, and post-training supplement, it will give you a hardness and fullness to your muscles like you've never felt before. As an endurance supplement, Carbolin has been proven to increase VO2 max by 2.8%. If you want fast absorption and sustained energy without bloating or cramping, get Carbolin. Go to AAEFX.com today. Whey Natural USA is the best whey protein in the world. Not only is it from Amish grass-fed cows inside the United States, but it's the only grass-fed whey in the world that is not heat pasteurized. Don't be fooled by other grass-fed whey products that are low heat pasteurized. Only the patented Chill-Rite process leaves all the natural fractions of whey intact to boost your immune system while building more muscle. And Whey Natural USA is also the lowest price for non-heat pasteurized grass-fed whey protein in the world. Don't waste your time on products that only deliver 15 grams of protein per scoop. Choose the best with 25 grams of protein per scoop. Whey Natural USA. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Whey Natural USA banner ad today to see why anything less is wasting your money. New from Rob Ragish, author of The Blueprint and SHR's own Blueprint Power Hour, comes the Blueprint Bulletin. Every month, Rob delivers the absolute latest and greatest information right to your inbox. Everything's on the table, including training, diet, supplementation, gray market products, and more. This is a fantastic way to stay one step ahead of your competition and use these secrets to up your game. Go to theblueprintbulletin.com or click the Blueprint Bulletin banner ad on superhumanradio.com to get your free introductory issue. Go to theblueprintbulletin.com today. Electronic muscle stimulation is state-of-the-art for pain management and muscle recovery. Now from ABC Medical comes the Pain Pod. Pain Pod is a professional strength EMS unit and provides 12 therapeutic modes and 20 intensity settings. It comes with everything you need. Small, convenient, rechargeable, and portable. But make no mistake, Pain Pod delivers commercial-grade strength for immediate pain relief. The Pain Pod normally sells for $349, but for a limited time, the Superhuman Nation
can get the Pain Pod for only $200, including shipping. Pain Pod comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Pain Pod banner ad today to learn more.
Your radio just got ripped. It's Superhuman Radio.
And here we are, the tag team of science, Adele Moussa and Carl Lenore. Okay, during the break, Adele and I were messaging each other, and I said, I think I'm going to start doing low doses of sodium bicarbonate throughout the day to do this serial loading approach instead of the acute loading approach. And he said he laces his water with his, and I said, I'm just going to snort mine. So we do it the American style here.
Yeah, and what I forgot to mention before the break was actually that it also increased the absorption and uptake of creatine into the cell. And we all know a certain brand which claims that it has the best absorbability of creatine. And if you look at the label and at the patent, you will see that it contains something that's called soda ash, and that's nothing but bicarbonate, but in a very low dose.
Yeah, because it neutralizes the stomach acids, basically, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Okay, so this next study is really intriguing to me. Why do we even care if football players have high blood pressure, first of all?
Well, the next segment actually is about the beneficial health effects of exercise, and we all think that professional athletes are the epitome of health, and
yes.
This study is really interesting because the athletes actually had normal blood pressure when it was measured just once a day. But when they were this cuff, which measures your blood pressure at several time points over 24 hours and also in the night, they realized that about one third of them had some sort of blood pressure abnormal.
Have you ever had to wear one of those automatic blood pressure cuffs, Adele?
Oh, yeah, I had, yeah.
Okay, so when you're in the hospital, you know what? First of all, I happen to be one of those people who gets white coat syndrome. My blood pressure goes up. So now what I do is I tell the doctor, I get white coat syndrome. So you're going to have to take my blood pressure a couple times in order to get a true reading. And sure enough, it drops 10 points by the second reading and another 10 points by the third reading every single time because I freak out when somebody's going to take my blood pressure. I don't know why. But I do. So, and I've been doing this since I was a young kid. I had a doctor. His name was Dr. Miriam. I'll never forget it. He said to me, you have white coat syndrome. I must have been about 13 years old. And he started talking to me about my wristwatch and took my blood pressure a second time and said, oh, you're fine. And so with that being said, those automatic blood pressure cuffs, when that thing starts pumping, it's like, oh, man, here it comes again. And they squeeze the arm so damn hard. That's why I am still baffled why we check blood pressure the way we do. First of all, there are so many variables that affect blood pressure. Is the arm horizontal at the same height as the heart? Is it hanging down? That alone will change blood pressure 3 to 5%. Also, when did squeezing a hose give you a true rendition of what the pressure of the fluid in the hose is? If it's a thick hose, you're squeezing a thick hose, it could be empty and you're going to get a reading. So when are we going to change the way we read blood pressure to begin with? This is like caveman style of reading blood pressure.
Well, you're right. Have you ever worn such a device for 24 hours?
Yes, when I was in the hospital. And the damn thing would start pumping on its own and it would scare the heck out of me.
Well, then you're special because I had to do this when I was 17, I believe, and I had checkup at the military service, and I had also white coat syndrome,
right? White coat syndrome.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I had to wear one of those cuffs for 24 hours, and at first it always freaked me out, but in the end I ended up sleeping like a baby in the night and did not really notice that it inflated and checked my blood pressure even overnight. So I think it's not the worst thing to do it this way. But one thing I've been wondering about is also whether, for example, people with a very low body fat percentage and very flexible flexible veins, whether for them this can even be as appropriate as for somebody where you have a few centimeters of
fat,
subcutaneous fat, covering the veins. So I'm wondering how this can actually work for all of them.
Yes,
and especially in the case of those automatic devices, because a doctor can still change the pressure and listen and react appropriately, but these devices are programmed for Mr. Average Joe. And we all know that most of the listeners of Superhuman Radio and also of the readers of the Subversity are luckily not Mr. Average Joe. So how accurate will this be for you?
Well, and then also the size of the arm. If your doctor does not have, if you walk into your doctor's office and you don't have 9-inch upper arms, then they have to go for a larger cuff. If they don't have that larger cuff, it changes the reading dramatically. I have had a doctor read my blood pressure with the standard cuff, and it was ridiculously high. And I said, don't you have one of those larger cuffs? He goes, oh, yeah, it's in another room. I says, well, could you get it and read it? Actually, it was the nurse. The doctor didn't do it. And she, you know, begrudgingly went down the hall and came back with it and put it on, and my blood pressure was 122 over 80 when she read it with that cuff, but it was like 160 over 93 with the other cuff. There are so many variables that can screw up a blood pressure reading that I am still to this day baffled why doctors, why we haven't found a better way. I mean, with thermography and all these other technologies, we should be able to put something on somebody's arm and actually be able to tell what the pressure is inside the vein without taking into account, as you point out, the structural challenges of different levels of body fat. And also, for those of us who lift heavy, we know that 10 years of Valsalva upregulates the thickness of our arteries and veins. We have thicker hoses to begin with.
Yeah, correct. But still, the validity of the study is actually not that skewed off, because one of the central problems was, and this wouldn't be influenced by the measuring technique, because you would have a BS in all the values.
Okay.
One of the central problems was actually that there was not the regular nocturnal dip in blood pressure levels. So the blood pressure did not really go down, and this is actually something which reminded me of another study we've been talking about long ago, where the subjects who trained less had much greater weight loss success. And this idea of always doing more and more, and the problem of getting overtrained is actually related to this, because if you are in a state of sympathetic overtraining, so you're psyched up all the day and all the night, of course, then your blood pressure won't go down.
Right.
And you could argue that, for example, if they did this study in the preparation phase, where you're deliberately overreaching as a trained athlete, then this would be normal. And in another state where you would expect the athlete to be well recovered, this should not occur.
You know, and you have to take into account the fact that football players are probably using energy drinks and stuff like that, and that has to play a role on the fact that you don't have the normal sympathetic, parasympathetic nervous system push and pull on these parameters as well. I mean, there's so many things that play into this. But the bottom line was that the individuals who had presented in office with normal blood pressure readings, when they tracked them, they found out that they, in fact, had higher ambulatory blood pressure readings, and they did not see that nocturnal dip at all, right? A large percentage of them.
Exactly, and that is really the main problem, because, or this is what I wanted to point out, because it goes against this as long as you exercise, and the more you exercise, the better. This is clearly not the case, and we'll also see this in the next study. Maybe we can go jump right to that.
Yes, please.
This is a very, very interesting study, which investigated the optimal running dosage for life extension. And I know that this is one of your favorite topics, life extension and living longer. And what they found is that the They only investigated the difference between non-joggers and joggers, and they looked at three parameters. How long did the joggers perform their exercise per week? And you see a clear pattern that in the below 1 hour and the 1 hour to 2.5 hours of exercise or of jogging per week, you have a significant increase in life expectancy. So if you think about this, say 2.1 hours, this would be, or about
2.5 hours.
Yeah, 2.5 hours would be the maximum, which yielded a really significant benefit. And if you listen or if you look in the mainstream media, you always get the impression you better jog every day, and the more, the better, and you will live longer. But this is clearly not the case.
Well, but you could jog every day if you just did a half hour.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, and so what parameters did they look at in order to determine effect on longevity, Adele?
The total hours per week.
No. What markers did they look at in the body to say, okay, what you're doing will enhance longevity. What you're doing is going to decrease longevity.
Oh, they tracked a group of people for years.
Oh.
This study started, I think, 15 years ago. And they then looked at all-cause mortality, and they looked at cardiovascular markers and other diseases.
Oh, great!
And calculated estimated the average lifetime based on that.
Now, surely the high-intensity group was the one that was promoting longevity, right? The ones that were running fast all the time, right?
Yeah, that's what you would expect, but unfortunately, this was clearly not the case. In fact, they had a 22% increase in, or a 22% risk of decreased life expectancy. So compared to those who are running at the medium pace, which had an almost 50% increase in chances to live longer. And this also goes to tell you that there's a relatively narrow zone where you really get benefits. And
so what is considered a medium pace? Like 2.5 miles an hour, 3 miles an hour, 5 miles an hour? What is it?
In the study they said they did not really give a exact quantification because they asked the participants to judge this by themselves, and this criteria was the classic one where you say you could when you're jogging with a partner, you could be talking all the time.
Right.
So for somebody who's really fit, this would be faster.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. This is actually a subjective measurement, because perceived exhaustion is indicative of whether or not you're jogging at a medium pace or not.
Yeah, that's the kind of jogging, and also the duration of jogging, where you get home and say, "Wow, I feel great." This is when you're jogging, for example, in the morning and feel you have more energy than when you're not doing it.
God, that is such a good point, because, you know, lately my training, I've been leaving the gym feeling like King Kong. So obvious, and I'm not spending nearly as much time training. I'm getting in and getting out, but I'm working very hard for the period of time. I've cut back on some of the unnecessary movements, focusing on the bigger movements, and I leave the gym feeling fantastic instead of exhausted. So maybe this method, this metric of measurement, can also be applied to resistance training as well.
It can be applied to every training. And just like the third variable, you need to get adequate rest, because the only ones who benefited were those who trained 1 to 3 times per week. People who trained more than 4 times per week, they also had an increased risk of reduced life expectancy. So you really need your body to give your body the time to recover. And there is obviously a co-founding factor which is not included here, because you can safely assume that those who trained 4 times a week, or most of them, were also running for longer times and were also running faster.
Yeah.
So
these
parameters are not totally unrelated to each other. But in general, you see that there is a happy medium. And I think what you said, the feeling like King Kong, this is actually quite funny. We don't want to reward ourselves. We don't want to feel good. We do want to feel beat down when we are leaving the gym or when we are back from our jog. And this is not the way you train, especially not if your goal is longevity. And I would say even not if your goal is to build muscle or to increase your performance. You can do this, in a very controlled fashion, but not forever and not like every day.
Yeah. Yeah. You gotta take time off. There's no doubt about it. And you gotta go in and you have to detrain. But the question is, how do you cycle it to get the most effect? And that's obviously going to be the question that's going to be around for a long time. Okay, so we can move on to yet another subject, and that is, to stay in the vein of, no pun intended, I lost the page here. I'm sorry, Adele.
We could go on with the peppermint oil.
Yes, the chronic ingestion of peppermint oil increases performance in young men. This is a really interesting one.
Yeah, it is, and it also fits in with the jogging, because it will mainly increase endurance performance, I suppose. The thing the scientists measured after administering 0.05 milliliters of peppermint essential oil for 10 days were actually parameters related to your ability to consume oxygen, so to breathe in and breathe out. And the subsequent increases in time to exhaustion and work and power, which were all statistically highly significant, were, at least as the scientists believe, mostly a result of this increased oxygen delivery to the tissues. And I would say that I personally would not have expected to see so profound effects from something as simple as peppermint oil. And I even wouldn't have had the idea to consume it orally as part of a drink every day for 10 days in order to improve my performance.
Right, right. Very interesting. And, you know, when I chew peppermint-flavored chewing gum while I work out, I notice it wakes me up. I don't know if that's the effect of the peppermint oil, but it definitely it wakes me up and it allows me to breathe better as well.
Yeah, that's certain, yeah.
Okay, let's move right on to something that's been debated over and over again, and that is the effectiveness of stretching. Is it good? Is it bad? Some people say you shouldn't stretch. Others say you're a fool if you don't stretch. What is this study about, Adele?
Yeah, I wouldn't have picked this study if it was just about stretching is bad for you, because it's basically, it has been convincingly shown that stretching before you work out will decrease your strength. At least if you do it in the classic static way. But this study actually was the first one to look at how long you would have to stretch in order to see persistent increases in flexibility. And what they found is pretty interesting, because you would have to stretch at least 180 seconds, or to hold each stretch for at least 180 seconds in order to elicit this benefit. And when I'm looking at people stretching in the gym, most of them stretch for 10 or 15 seconds or so. And when you talk to them, they say, well, I know that stretching is not so good for my performance, but I want to increase my flexibility. And if you consider that, then they would have to stretch at least 10 times longer in order to achieve any effect.
Right. Interesting. So you have to stretch a lot longer than most people think. All right, let's do this. Let's take a quick commercial break. When we come back, we've got lots of good subjects still to discuss. You're listening to the Subversity Science Roundup with the brilliant Adele Moussa. You can get to take advantage of Adele's brilliance every day by going to subversity.com. Adele never rests. He's posting things while people are sleeping. And don't miss it. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more Superhuman Radio. Cause in the dark, you can see shiny cars, and that's when you need me there. With you, I'll always share. All alone, I sit for my phone, I'm waiting for you. There are a few products.
that I believe in the way I believe in CanSee eye drops. I've been using CanSee for 6 months now, and the changes in my vision are nothing short of amazing. My near vision has improved, and I can read small print from 8 inches. My overall vision is clearer, and the glare from oncoming headlights doesn't bother me any longer. Just 1 to 2 drops a day, and the results are visible. You can find CanSee eye drops at wisechoicemedicine.net or call 800-861-4936. That's 800-861-4936. wisechoicemedicine.net. CanSee eye drops. The name says it all.
No other peptide supplier has a more complete offering than Southern Research Companies. And no other peptide supplier can boast that all their research peptides are manufactured inside the United States in Tier 1 labs. Whether you're looking for IGF-1 Long R3, GHRP6, GHRP2, Melanotan 2, Mechano Growth Factor, or PT-141, or hard-to-find peptides like Triptorelin or Follistatin, you'll find them at Southern Research Companies. Free shipping on orders over $150. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Southern Research banner ad today and do business with the most trusted name in research peptides, Southern Research Companies.
Superhuman Radio has the smartest and most dedicated health and fitness listeners found anywhere in the world. If you're trying to tap this market of greater than 50 million health fitness consumers, you simply can't do better than advertising on Superhuman Radio. Our sponsors tell us Superhuman Radio outperforms other forms of advertising time and time again. If you're tired of wasting valuable advertising dollars and need a new way to build your client base, go to superhumanradio.com and click on the Advertise with Us link. It just may be the best thing you have ever done for your business.
My friends are always asking me what I do to keep my face so youthful and fresh looking. I use RG Cell Super Stem Cell Support. RG Cell is the only cosmeceutical with penetrating anti-aging messenger molecules that activate old and dormant stem cells to restore your skin to a healthier, younger appearance. This helps to repair DNA, stimulate new cell growth, and aggressively eliminate wrinkles. You can learn more by visiting superhumanradio.com and clicking the RG Cell banner ad today.
Usually something for nothing is worth nothing, but go to superhumanradio.com and click the Life Extension banner ad to get a 1-year Life Extension Foundation membership free, plus a $25 product credit. So what does that buy you? Cutting-edge information, knowledgeable health advisors, huge discounts on blood tests and supplements. Want to stay younger and healthier longer? Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Life Extension banner ad and become a Life Extension member now. No cost, no obligation, no kidding. Way Natural USA is the best whey protein in the world. Not only is it from Amish grass-fed cows inside the United States, but it's the only grass-fed whey in the world that is not heat pasteurized. Don't be fooled by other grass-fed whey products that are low heat pasteurized. Only the patented Chill-Rite process leaves all the natural fractions of whey intact to boost your immune system while building more muscle. And Whey Natural USA is also the lowest price for non-heat pasteurized grass-fed whey protein in the world. Don't waste your time on products that only deliver 15 grams of protein per scoop. Choose the best with 25 grams of protein per scoop. Whey Natural USA. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Whey Natural USA banner ad today to see why anything less is wasting your money.
Get stronger. Feel younger. It's Superhuman Radio.
Either you're with those who love freedom or you're with those who hate innocent life.
All inferior creatures are to be considered the enemy of the dark.
I got to get this song out of them. Inventory.
Are you the enemy?
Too long of an intro. Welcome back to the Subversity Science Roundup. Okay. We can move fast, Adele. We have a lot of good subjects still to cover. I would like to try and start off with the DHEA study, because a lot of people are taking DHEA, and some are concerned that it may actually cause some changes in the body, especially as it relates to endogenous hormone production like testosterone. So what does this study point to?
Well, this study was unfortunately only done in rodents, but you probably wouldn't find any volunteer who would allow you to desiccate his testes or their testes,
right.
So to say. And therefore, it is obvious that you can only do studies like this in rodents. And the main finding of this particular study is actually that a long-term administration of approximately 50 milligrams, or this would be the human equivalent dose of DHA, for a couple of weeks did not only have no negative effects on the morphology of the testes, but actually the rodents in the treatment group had less lesions in their testes than the ones in the placebo group who just received a placebo. So in terms of testicular health and also of prostate health, there does not really seem to be a problem with DHEA supplementation. And what was also quite impressive is that the actual levels of DHEA in those rodents, they were 9 times higher than normal. So this amount of DHEA increased the levels by 800%, and it also doubled the testosterone levels. Unfortunately, they did not measure the estrogen, but there is another recent study also on DHA, same dosage, but in this kind, case in human beings, and postmenopausal women, to be precise.
And this is one that this is one I would have never bet on, and I'll tell you why. Because I've always understood that DHEA is a reciprocal hormone to melatonin, and so taking it at night could actually impair sleep.
Yeah, well, in this case, it did not. And the interesting thing is that these 50 milligrams of DHEA the women took at 11 p.m. right before bed, it did really improve their sleep. It also had a beneficial effect on some of the postmenopausal problems you have, especially when you are supposed to sleep. And interestingly, it did not have any effects on the thyroid function, on the secretion of growth hormone, of prolactin, of ACTH, which is actually the hormone which will increase cortisol levels, and also did not decrease or increase cortisol, because you could have said that when you administer DHEA right before bed, it could be possible that it will shut down your adrenal glands, and this therefore you wouldn't produce cortisol and sleep better. But the scientists actually ascribed this effect to an increase in testosterone and estrogen, and it was the benefits were particularly pronounced in those women where the difference between the increase in testosterone and estrogen was most pronounced, which means the more testosterone or the more testosterone was produced from the DHEA, the better the women slept.
Interesting. You know, and I wonder if this is true in men as well.
Maybe a word. Yeah, well, it's possible. And what's also interesting is that in general, if you look at the average woman, so to say, in the study, most of the DHEA actually ended up as being converted to testosterone. And one thing we should not forget, and we've been talking about that in a previous show, is that DHEA also has a relatively low, but it does have a binding affinity to the estrogen receptor. And therefore, I'm not quite sure whether some of the older studies, especially, where they found huge increases in estrogen in men, could not have been thwarted by the assay they used, so that they actually detected the DHEA and not the estrogen binding to
the receptor,
whatever they used to probe that. Yeah.
Oh yes, whatever they used for the assay. You know, you're right. That's really that's something. The next study is one that I would have argued against. First of all, oral HCG, I have not believed really works. I have believed that you cannot get a protein that size, that high of molecular weight, into the body, by ingesting.
Yeah, you can't.
Okay.
The interesting thing is that this scientist really acknowledge, or they know what they are doing, and they're not telling people that you can use HCG oral, but they developed a new molecule with a very small molecular weight, which is an LH antagonist of itself, which means it works like luteinizing hormone in your body. It can be consumed orally, and this is a new invention. So I just called this quasi-oral HCG, because it is like oral HCG would work if it would work.
Gotcha.
And therefore, okay. It's a very interesting invention, which has already been used in women to induce ovulation. So this means this is already very far in development and does actually work. And when you think about it, HCG is also used by men on testosterone replacement and for other reasons, this new drug could actually be a very convenient replacement when it hits the market.
Here's an interesting discussion about HCG. HCG has actually contributed to the creation of a long-acting growth hormone. They have taken a portion of the tail of HCG and added it to growth hormone, and we are looking at a growth hormone that's being produced right now for experimentation, for research, that has a 7-day half-life in the body, similar to IGF-1 long R3, but it does not require attachment to albumin. It stays intact. It stays in the bloodstream for 7 days at a time. Now, is this a good thing? I don't think so, because growth hormone is one of those things that has a pulse like smoke. It dissipates very quickly. So what challenges will occur in the body to a constantly present level of growth hormone remains to be seen. But by taking the tail of the HCG peptide, they've created a long-acting growth hormone, and you'll be reading more about it in the upcoming months.
Yeah, and the issue of pulsatility is actually pretty interesting because this particular molecule is actually pretty short-acting. There are two different drugs currently in the development, and one has a half-life of 70 hours, and 17 hours, and the other one has a half-life of 30 hours. So used appropriately, it's probably not that much of a problem of having constantly elevated levels. And this is particularly important. I don't know if it's that important for men, but it's very important for women, which really depend on this pulsatility in order to keep regular, so to say, in terms of their menstrual cycle.
Okay, last thing we want to cover, and is actually three different research pieces on fish oil and omega-3 to omega-6 fatty acids. So let's start with the first one.
Well, the first one actually tailors directly to what we've been talking about before. How do you optimize your testosterone production with fish oil? Could be the topic. Or rather, by tweaking the ratios of omega-3 to omega-6 fatty acids. And the researchers did this research again in rodents, and they fed the rodents different, or omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids, in different ratios. And as it turns out, the optimal ratio appears to be about 1-to-1, at least if you look at the endocrine effects this will have, because the maximum testosterone levels in this particular study may have been reached with 1.5. To one, so meaning 1.5 units of omega-3 fatty acids for 1 unit of omega-6 fatty acids, but the difference is not that large that the spike could not, the absolute optimum could not also have been a little more to the left. And there is one thing that's a little problematic about this study. They did not really include effects other fatty acids may also have had. Because if you add, for example, monounsaturated fatty acids to the equation, those will also have a different effect. And in this study, this was not really incorporated. So I would say that the take-home message of this study is that you should aim to get a 1-to-1 ratio, at least if you rely on this rodent study and want to increase your testosterone levels. The effect is not really large, but statistically significant. And as you have often pointed out in previous shows, Carl, being fertile is actually a sign of being healthy. And therefore you can probably conclude that this would also be a ratio which would leave you healthy. And what you've said today in the show before, you would probably get to a ratio like this if you were eating a natural diet in terms of consisting of foods which are produced in the original way, because we know that actually there is not that much omega-6 in most of the meat if the right animals were not fed with grains and other stuff that provides them with those omega-6 fatty acids.
Right. Okay, long-term intake of fish oil increases oxidative stress and decreases lifespan in senescence-accelerated mice. These are mice that get old very fast, right?
Yeah.
And so the fish oil didn't help them.
No, it did not, no. And actually, the problem appears that the fish oil, or this is also something I've mentioned in previous shows, all the PUFAs are highly oxidizable, but the fish oil is oxidized even faster. And when it's incorporated into the cell membrane and gets oxidized there, then you're running into trouble. And this is actually what the scientists already speculated in this study would be the reason that the life expectancy of the mice decreased from 56 weeks to 48 weeks. And they did a follow-up study, not in human beings, but in roundworms, in C. elegans, because, of course, this study it goes even faster. The worms don't live as long. And in a very simple organism like that, you can really control what happens. And they could actually confirm that the problem really is the oxidation of the omega-3 fatty acids, which are built into the cell membrane. And they did also, or they were also able to show that administering large amounts of vitamin E with the fish oil to these worms did actually forestall the effect. So a problem really does only occur when you administer the fish oil into an environment where which is full of inflammation and does not provide the appropriate amounts of antioxidants to keep the oxidation or the rate of oxidation level.
So the bottom line is fish oil is no different than any other fat. If you oxidize it, it becomes bad for you. So if you're taking fish oil, you also must pay attention to taking antioxidants. And, you know, I hate to pimp a product, but I'm taking the Altrient C and the Altrient Glutathione together. And I do take a whole vitamin E supplement that has all 8 isoforms of vitamin E as well. I feel like I'm getting a lot of good antioxidants as a result. So I guess I don't have to be too afraid of oxidizing my fish oil or other fats as well.
Yeah, you're right. But on the other hand, one of the main messages here is also that we are probably not designed to consist of too much omega-3 fatty acids in terms of our cells. And if there is, for example, if there are other fats like saturated fats incorporated all as well, then the structure is more robust because those are not oxidized. Those don't get oxidized as fast. You really need the right mixture.
Yeah.
And I did forget to mention that before because one of the findings of the interesting findings of the study, which investigated the testosterone was, that once you escalated, the ratio beyond the 1.5, so beyond 1.5 units of omega-3 to, one unit of omega-6, you saw detrimental effects on the testosterone and also on the sperm count and other parameters they measured. So the solution is not to exclude all other fats from your diet and live off fish oil alone.
Right.
Especially because in the roundworm study, those negative effects were also observed when the roundworms received fish oil which was already oxidized. And this is a major problem with all those products. Although they have small amounts of vitamin E in them, you don't know what happens to the products when they are stored. And even if they have been tested by the manufacturer, all sorts of things can happen in the time between.
Right.
And even time alone will have them oxidized.
And you know,
this is another reason I really recommend to eat fish instead of consuming fish oil.
Yeah, but a lot of people don't like fish. That's the problem. There's a lot of people out there who won't eat fish for one reason or another, especially fatty fish.
Yeah. Maybe they always get the rancid fish because they are dining at the wrong restaurant.
Well, there's a Japanese restaurant that Elisa and I love here in Louisville. And when we go there, I order 3 orders of salmon sashimi and a salad. And it comes out to 21 pieces of salmon sashimi. Each one is about an ounce. And so it's 21 ounces of raw salmon. And I have to tell you, when I eat that, I don't feel it in my stomach. It's not like I feel like, oh my God, that's so much. It disappears so quickly. I wish I could eat that two or three times a week instead of taking fish oil supplements.
You really have to wonder how different this is if you really consume fresh fish. It's not, even if it's fatty, it's not lying in your stomach like stones.
Right.
Which many people are actually complaining about with fish oil, by the way. And I'm not quite sure, but I suspect that the more bothering you have going on, the older and the more oxidized the stuff you just ingested actually is.
If I take Carlson's lemon flavored fish oil on an empty or semi-empty stomach, or if I don't take it with a high fat meal, I burp it up for hours. It's in my stomach for hours. I just keep belching it and I can taste that lemon flavor. I have to take it with a meal. I take it usually after I've consumed a meal that has adequate amount of fat in it. I'll take 2 tablespoons of Carlson's fish oil. If I take that same dose, and I only do it I do it very haphazardly, a few times a week. But if I take that same dose on an empty or semi-empty stomach, I will burp it up for hours. And I don't understand that. Cause I can eat a hunk of coconut oil and I don't burp it up. It doesn't come back up.
Yeah, you could argue that maybe it is the oxidation process already starts when the fish oil is exposed to the highly acidic environment in your stomach.
Yeah.
So this could be an effect. And I think there even was a study investigating how much of the fish oil actually is oxidized when you ingest it on its own. And the bottom line was better have it with a meal in order to make sure that it is absorbed intake.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I agree with that. I found that out the hard way. Anyway.
I mean, you just have to think about it. It's supposed to be in the fish, not in a cap.
Yeah. Oh, I take it in a teaspoon, a tablespoon. I just put it in my mouth and drink it down. So that's even worse.
Okay. Even worse. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, we've got to pull the plug on the show. We went long. Adele, thank you as usual for all the diligent hard work you put into the Subversity Science Roundup and that you put into your blog as well. To those of you who are not familiar, please visit subversity.com, SUPPVERSITY.com. The vast amount of information and the scope of information that Adele puts out is just admirable from my standpoint and astonishing from the average person who is looking for answers about nutrition, exercise, hell, even problems with your kids. So go to subversity.com today. Thank you so much, Adele. And also, I want to thank, let's see, who was on earlier? I lost my paper here. Here you go. Dr. Jason Lake from the Department of Sports and Exercise Science, University of Chichester, for coming on and talking about how knee wraps affect back squatting. And Dr. Casey Vickers from Vanderbilt School of Medicine, for coming on and talking about the importance of not classifying all HDL cholesterol the same. Some is good, some is bad. We need to learn more about that. Thanks for being on the show today, Adele.
It was a pleasure.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. See everybody tomorrow for a Casual Friday. Elise is already working on it. I know we're going to have a great show for you.
This is the Superhuman Channel, doing reps with the weight of the world.
My friends are always asking me what I do.